and Sanctuary with Emma Newman. Hello, my lovelies. I hope you're well. Welcome to episode 4, season 2 of Tea and Sanctuary. Now, if this is your first time listening to this podcast or watching it on YouTube, and you're wondering what on earth this is about, I promise that this is one of the lowest stakes, coziest, safest podcasts out there. Obviously, I haven't listened to every one of the millions of them that exist in the world today, but I want you to rest assured that there is going to be nothing that is stressful or upsetting. This is Tea and Sanctuary, not Tea and Current Affairs, which is a podcast I think I could never make because I would just get so angry and so upset. There are so many awful, awful things happening in the world, but none of them are happening here. You're safe now. So, what would I like to talk about today? I've made some notes about some things because the thing I always worry about when I start to record is that I'm just going to go completely blank. But the whole thing about this podcast is that it's completely unstructured and unscripted. And one of the things that I want to talk about today is bookish things. Now, that is probably quite unsurprising, given that I'm an author and books have always been incredibly important to me. But I have a confession to make. Over the past, I don't know, when did it start? I think maybe nearly 10 years. Can it be 10 years? Good grief. Time is meaningless. Definitely for the past 5 years. And I think a bit before that, I really could not read for pleasure. And that just sounds like the most absurd statement to me, because all of my life, up until this recent kind of slump, I read so much. As a teenager, one of my favourite things was to read an entire book in a day. And I remember having long baths and just reading and reading and reading, and it was such a big part of my life. And then I think in more recent years, it was a combination of narrating, where it kind of turned into a job, but it wasn't so much that. It was, I think, the fact that when a book comes in, there's often not a long period of time that you have to prepare the book. And so I might get the manuscript a couple of weeks, at the very most, 3 weeks before recording. It varies depending on the project. Also, sometimes my schedule with other work doesn't give me the chance to prepare until very soon before the actual recording. And so that means that I have to read very intensely, very quickly. And I've always been a very fast reader, so that's not so much of a problem, but I think it's turned into part of my job. I think the other aspect as well was when I became an author and when my books started to have some moderate success, lots of publishers started to send me books to blurb. Like, it was amazing having these books arriving that hadn't come out yet, and I was really excited to read. But I think that there was a spell when there were just so many arriving that it just turned into this huge pressure. It wasn't just the pressure to get them read in a time window. It was also knowing that author, because they're often debut authors, that they really need endorsements and support from the writing community. And so I felt this kind of burden. Somewhere along the way, combined with a really, really, really stressful few years where I just have found it incredibly difficult just to rest, just generally, just rest, that's all combined and conspired to make it impossible for me to read. But just a couple of weeks ago, I'd been reading Sir Patrick Stewart's make it so in little bursts over several months, because I just couldn't. I couldn't let myself sink into it. I went away to Shropshire to house it, and I could read it in bursts there, and that was great. But it was reading at home that I'd lost the ability to do. And I very rarely go away. I can't afford to go on holidays. I don't go on holiday. So it was one of those things where if I couldn't figure out how to do this at home as part of my everyday life, I just wasn't reading anymore. And as an author, that is a terrible state of affairs, because it's not the only way to replenish the well, that internal well that everything comes out of. But it's always a really good idea to know what is being said in the conversation within your genre, or to read extensively outside of genre. And I would say both are important, because it's all about knowing how other people do things. Like it's a constant learning exercise. And I think maybe that was another part of why I'd lost the love of reading for pleasure. I was starting to find it impossible to read without analysing and constantly dissecting the way that the author had approached a scene or why a particular turn of phrase worked. But reading Sir Patrick Stewart's memoir, it was, I think, the first memoir I've ever read. And so it was a completely different type of book. And I enjoyed it so much. And a couple of weeks ago, I realised I had like the last quarter or so of the book to go. And it got to the section that was all the Star Trek Next Generation years. And I just really wanted to read it. And I sat down one evening and just finished the book, just sat and read for a couple of hours. And it was revelatory. It was such, it sounds ridiculous, but it feels like it was this magical experience. I actually felt myself calm down and self-regulate. And after that, I've been reading again for pleasure, and I can't express what a relief it is. After finishing his book, I went on to The Goldfinch, and I'm really enjoying that. I've completely blanked on the name of the author. Is it Donna Tartt? I can't remember. Good grief. If only I was a semi-professional and made notes before recording. I think that's the name. I'm terrible with names. So, yes, I'm about halfway through that book, but that book is a chonky boy. It's like that. It's so thick. And I'm about halfway through, and that's the size of the average kind of longish novel. And I'm enjoying it immensely. But more than that, I'm enjoying the act of sitting down and reading. And in a world where everything is screens, like my day-to-day working life, I spend hours and hours and hours in front of my computer. And then in the evening to sit down in front of a television and relax, it's just another screen. And just not looking at anything electronic, there's just something that's quite spiritually enjoyable about that. So I want to talk about books. I can't talk about The Goldfinch yet because I haven't finished it. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about Make It So. And that's Sir Patrick Stewart's memoir. I enjoyed it immensely. One of the things that I really loved about the memoir, it was just very, very easy to read. I have no idea if he himself wrote it or whether he worked with a ghostwriter. But in some ways, I kind of don't care, because it sounds like him telling his life story. It sounds, the style is so easy and so conversational and warm and engaging that if he sat and dictated it to a ghostwriter who then tidied it up, or he sat and wrote it himself, it doesn't matter. The style is so engaging. I honestly don't mind. One of the things I was really surprised to find within those pages was the story of the decline of the arts in the UK. And I've just suddenly thought, I promised you I wasn't going to talk about anything stressful. And so I'm not going to go into this too much, because If you've ever seen me on a panel at a convention, or you know me in real life, you know that I contain the rage of ages within me. I am constantly furious. I am like the Hulk. I am constantly furious about the state of the world and everything that is happening. That it's just so awful, and it infuriates me. And one of the things that he talks about in describing his career is what it used to be like to be an actor in the 1960s and the 1970s in England. The sheer number of theatres that existed, but more importantly, the sheer amount of investment in the arts that took place. And one of the things that he mentions is how the government in the post-war period was very, very socialist. And we know that. There was a mass house building program. The NHS was born. That sounds very strange. The NHS was founded. There was a huge drive to improve people's lives. And one of the things he mentions, and I wish I had kind of marked it up or taken a picture of it, was something about how the people in power at the time knew the value of a happy, flourishing, nourished population in different ways, and that nourishing them with the arts was just as important as the NHS. Because in a society that is healthy and happy, you're steering away from the things that contribute to war. And I thought there was something beautiful about that. I really wish I didn't have to paraphrase it, but it was something along those lines. The sheer amount of support that there was for children and young people who wanted to go into theatre that he experienced himself. You know, he came from a proper working class background and had opportunities that simply don't exist today. And it made me think of something that Michael Sheen, 1,000 blessings upon him, the true Prince of Wales, as I saw on a post online this morning. There was an interview that I saw a snippet of when somebody was talking about Port Talbot, I think it is. And they were saying, oh, isn't it incredible that Richard Burton and Anthony Hopkins and you all came from this same area of Wales? And he was like, no, it's not incredible. It's perfectly understandable, and it's all because of this one man who ran youth drama services, and that there was funding in place for that. So they had like an incubation location and period of time for young people who wanted to go into acting, and shock horror, it produced several incredibly successful and talented actors. This is something which is so dear to me, because I've seen this happening over my lifetime, just in the last 25 years, how much has changed and how much more difficult it is for young people now. I have a teenage son, and he simply will not have the opportunities that 16-year-olds 30 years ago had, because of the change in funding, because of the government. So what I'm wanting to say is that there's more in Sir Patrick Stewart's memoir than I thought there would be. Of course, there is a huge amount of theatre memories from childhood, etc., etc. It's incredibly candid. And he doesn't shy away from talking about awful things that he's done and terrible mistakes he made and moments when he was really ashamed of himself. And I loved the courage of that. But something that will stay with me from that book in particular is what it says about the state of my country. And I think that that is incredibly valuable. And the reason I'm talking about this is because it would be very easy, if you're not a huge fan of Star Trek The Next Generation, like I am, or Shakespeare, because obviously there's a huge swathe of people who only know him for his Shakespearean work, or for the X-Men franchise, or for I, Claudius. There's more to it than that. You will find other things in there that are incredibly interesting and enjoyable. So if it's something that you were like, eh, I'm not a huge fan of the stuff he's been in, I don't really know him as an actor, I would recommend it because it's just so interesting. It feels like a window into different periods of time that I found really fascinating. Staying on bookish things, I have a book that I reread. Well, there are two books that I reread every year. One is a short story collection called The Golden Apples of the Sun, which is a Ray Bradbury short story collection, and he is my favourite short story writer. I cried for an hour when he died. I was visiting my father at the time, obviously years ago, and saw the news online, and I just had to go into my room and cry for an hour to Dad's guest room. And I felt really embarrassed when I came back out. And I said, look, I'm really sorry, but like, I've read his stuff all my life and I adore his work. And I never wrote to him to say thank you. And now I'll never have the opportunity. And I'm just so upset. And I said, I'm really embarrassed. And he said, don't be embarrassed. What a beautiful thing that he had a life where someone who never met him cried when he died. How beautiful is that? My dad is such a good soul. And that short story collection contains the story A Sound of Thunder, which I think is a perfect short story. Technically perfect, emotionally perfect. Everything about it is just exquisitely done. And it's the story of a guy who pays to go on this safari, but the safari involves time travel. And you go back in time to shoot dinosaurs. And the whole shtick is that this company has gone back in time already, laid this path out so that if you stick to the path, you don't touch anything, you don't interact with anything. Because obviously, if you go back millions of years, thousands of years, however many years, whatever safari you pick, if you do something there, it could have a catastrophic knock-on effect in your present day when you get back. And so they go back, this company, in preparation for these safaris, and they watch each dinosaur and they work out when and where each dinosaur dies and they mark it. Obviously, the complete nerd that I am would argue that there is no way that you could ever do anything like this without changing something critical. But the whole conceit of the story is that they are very careful. They're as careful as they can be to make sure that what you do in the past has the same basic result. And then they take these safari hunters, these very wealthy people, back in time to have the thrill of shooting dinosaurs. Obviously, the bigger the better. And of course, something goes wrong. Now, this short story is I have no idea how long it is because it's in normal paperback form, just a few thousand words. And the way that it expresses all of this, the elegant exposition, the way that he demonstrates the impact of what has happened is just so well done. I cannot recommend that story highly enough. And this paperback copy of this collection, I have no idea when it was printed. Sometime in the 70s, I think, maybe the 80s. It's a very vintage book. It's very yellow and is very, very dog-eared from the years of love that it had before I found it in a secondhand bookshop and my own annual rereads. And there are some other stories in there that are utterly devastating. There's one that still haunts me about a guy who is a garbage collector. I use that phrase because it's set in America. We would say dustbin man would be the way that I would have said it as a kid. That's incredibly sexist. Anyway, this garbage collector in New York, I think it is, he has, if memory serves, I haven't done my annual reread yet, but if memory serves, he finds out about what the emergency process is in terms of nuclear war, and it kind of destroys him because obviously it has an impact on his job. And that is utterly devastating as a story. And they're just so varied. There's so much. There are so many different styles, subgenres. It's a gorgeous collection. The other book, which I have just done my annual reread of, that I get out every year, take down from my bookshelf, which is in my bedroom. In my bedroom, I have a unit that is big enough to have all of my absolutely most precious books. And this is one of them. They're all precious hardbacks. And for the benefit of the people who are watching on YouTube, for the benefit of people watching on YouTube, I'm holding it up. Oh, it's going to be all backwards. I don't know how to make that unbackwards. But this is a hardback, again, short story collection called Tales from Outer Suburbia by Sean Tan. And this is the most gorgeous, not only short story collection, but just work of art, because they're all illustrated. This hardback is gorgeous, and the front is all textured. If you can hear that sound, it's me rubbing my fingertips over the title, because it's kind of embossed into the front of the book. This collection, it was published by Templar, and I've had it for some years now, is absolutely extraordinary. Each of the short stories are really, really, really short. Some of them, I would imagine, are only like 500 words. Lots of them are around 1,000 to 2,000 words, and a couple of slightly longer ones. But the illustrations are just as important. And some of the stories are told through a mixture of illustrations and words. And there's one which is about poetry that is thrown away in the process of becoming a poet, or all of the failed poets out there, and what happens to the little scraps of poetry that they've ever written. And that's almost like a mixed media collage that tells a story. I can't express how much I love this collection and how important it is to me. It's a genre which I've come across a few times and haven't read enough in, and I would say that it's magical realism. And I'm even now doubting whether I've got that correct. What I mean by that, so forgive me if I've named it incorrectly, is that it's like the real world, but also there is just a lot of really weird stuff. It's like the real world, but just slightly out of kilter. And so things happen in it which are just so weird, but the majority of the world building is exactly as the normal world is today. And I find that such a compelling genre. There's a short story about a kid being told by their grandfather about his grandparents' wedding day and what happens. And it's told like this is what every wedding is like, but it's utterly bizarre and gorgeous. And there's a story about this tiny little strange creature that comes and lives with the family like a foreign exchange student, but it's like 3 inches high and is just really strange, and it's so beautiful, and it makes me cry every time I read this collection, not just because of the poignancy of the stories, it's also the beauty of it and the depth and the richness of the storytelling. And several of the stories are written in the second person. So it says, you know, you do this and you do that, and like that person has known you all their life. Oh, I can't recommend this highly enough. I don't know anything about Sean Tan. It's something that I realised as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about today. I was thinking that the strange thing about reading Sir Patrick Stewart's memoir is that I wouldn't say I know a lot about him. I feel I know more than I did, but I was aware of him as an actor and as a person before I read it. And when I really, really, really love a book, I don't tend to go and find out everything I can about the author, because for me, they're quite separate. The experience I've had from a book is its own thing. I don't feel I need to go and find out about the author, so I can't tell you anything about Sean Tan. The only thing I do know, because I've noticed it on the book, is that there is a kind of a thank you acknowledgement that the book was made possible by arts funding in Australia. That I didn't plan for that to tie neatly into what I was saying earlier. But yes, that there's an acknowledgement that there was some kind of arts funding that went into it. And it's produced something utterly exquisite. And if I could make something, if I could write something that did that for somebody else, that somebody loves what I've created so much that they read it every year, my goodness, that would just feel amazing. When I think about it lots, particularly when I do my reread of the collection, I still get upset that Ray Bradbury died. Never met him. No idea what he was like as a person. Absolutely no idea whatsoever. As an aside, he wrote a book about writing. Oh, good grief. Is it Zen in the Art of Writing? Actually, let me just give me a moment. I'm just going to turn around and have a look. Yes, it was. Sorry, I had to look on my bookshelf behind me. He wrote a book called Zen in the Art of Writing, which I also really loved. And it's a book that I recommend to anybody who is thinking about being a writer or struggling with early experiences of writing. I really, really enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. Sean Tan's book, I never would have discovered were it not for an incredible experience. In fact, I've had it twice at my favourite bookshop in the entire world, which is Mr. B's Emporium of Reading Delights in Bath. I can't remember if I've talked about this in another episode or not, but it doesn't matter because it deserves to be talked about multiple times. So this bookshop in Bath is in a Georgian building, and it's just so lovely. It's got lovely wooden floorboards. It has that smell of wood and books, which all bookshops should have. And you go through the downstairs area, which is, obviously really quite filled with books. And upstairs, you go through one room into another, and the room at the back is a little bit more like a living room in feel. And this is where something magical happens called a reading spa. And I have been gifted 2 reading spas in my lifetime. It is just the most amazing experience. So if you know somebody who loves books and you've got no idea what to give them as a gift, I'm going to give you the 2 best gifts you can give a book lover. One for people who are able to travel to Bath in England, and the other for people who cannot. So if you can travel to Bath, get a reading spa. And what happens is you go upstairs to the comfy kind of living room-esque area. I mean, I'm saying this, I haven't been there since the pandemic. I assume it's still there. I know they still offer them on the website, so I know that it's still there. But when I was there, that was the room that it happened in. And they sit you down and they ask you what kind of tea you like, and they get you a cake. You know, they check what you might want or not. They go and get you some freshly baked goods, presumably from another local bakery, and they bring you tea and they sit down and talk to you and have a long conversation with you, one of their booksellers, about books that you have loved, why you enjoyed them. And the booksellers at Mr. B's are incredible. There was a guy called Ed, and I hope he's still there and still happy to be there, because he was amazing. He did my book spa. The person listens to you, makes notes, and then you sit there having your tea and cake, relaxing, and then they bring you piles and piles of books tailor-picked for you following that conversation. I cannot express how luxurious this feels. It's the most incredible experience, and this is something which is, a top-tier gift. So I think I might have had it for my 40th birthday. I can't remember. No, I didn't. I didn't have it for my 40th. That was after the Split Worlds ball. And I had that in Oxford. I hired a room in Oxford and had a party for people who came and played in the Split Worlds LARP. Anyway, So it was a birthday before that, but it's, you know, it's a special gift. And they leave you alone for as long as you need to flick through the books, to start reading them, see if they fit with what you want. And included in the price of the reading spa is a chunk of money towards any of the books that you want to pick. So you know, as you're looking through them, that you don't have to pay for all of them. Obviously, if you got every single one, you'd have to pay the difference. But that was the thing that excited me as well, was that I knew that I could choose and I wouldn't have to worry about paying for it because it was part of the gift. And Tales from Outer Suburbia was one of the recommendations at this reading spa. And I absolutely fell in love with it. And I had to take it home. And it is one of my most favourite books of all time. And I never would have known that it existed. And I never would have even gone to look at that kind of book had it not been for that experience. So I completely recommend The Reading Spa at Mr. B's Emporium of Reading Delights. And if you can save up for it, if you can afford it, just as a gift for yourself, if you're a book lover, I cannot describe how good a gift this would be for yourself. The other gift that they do, which is for people who live abroad perhaps or live too far away, is that they do a gift subscription. So I got this, or we got this, for my ex-in-laws as a gift who live abroad. And Mr. B's sends, I think it's a questionnaire that they send about books that you love. So it's like a distance version of the reading spa. That may have changed. I don't know if it's still a questionnaire or if they do any kind of like Zoom call, because this was before the pandemic, like some years before the pandemic. So it's not something that you necessarily had back then. But anyway, they give you a questionnaire, you fill it in, and then they send you a book every month for 12 months, gift wrapped in brown paper. And it's just a beautiful sensory experience as well. And I've got that as a gift for them and also for another relative of mine. And the feedback was that they discovered new writers that they hadn't heard of before and absolutely loved. So if you're looking for broadening out, because sometimes, I don't know, I used to find, you know, if I had read one author in particular and read all of their work, that finding something that was similar but not nearly the same, because that leads to comparison, which can be very dissatisfying and jarring. It's that kind of thing where you can broaden out into other areas of the genre or new genres that have kind of transferable elements in them, and you discover new books and new writers. If you love somebody who is bookish, I highly recommend either of those gifts. And like I said, if you're able to, or if people say, well, what do you want for your birthday? And you can say, well, please, can you club together and get me a reading spa? That's a good way to love yourself. It's the only kind of spa I would ever be able to cope with. The whole idea of going to like beauty spas? No. That just seems awful. I cannot see the appeal of going to a strange place and no. But reading spas, going somewhere cozy that has a little fire and has an armchair and tea and cake and so many books. I mean, what's not to love? What is not to love? I think that's probably everything that I want to talk about in this episode. I just feel so happy and relieved to have fallen back in love with reading. But I think it's more than that, you know. I think the thing that I'm really heartened by is that it feels like I'm healing. And I don't want to get too heavy or too personal, perhaps. But after several incredibly traumatic years, it feels like there is some part of me that feels like I can actually feel safe enough to stop and rest for a few hours just to read. And what a gift that is. Yes, I think that's all I want to say for this episode. So a very, very, very bookish edition of Tea and Sanctuary. I'm sure you will forgive me. I hope that between now and the next time that we speak to each other, that you remember a book that you have read at some point in your life and absolutely loved, and you're able to go and find it and enjoy it again. And if that's not possible, to just take a few moments, perhaps over a nice cup of tea, to think about that book and how it felt to read it, what that world felt like to climb into. And I hope it makes you feel warm and happy. Take care, my lovelies. Bye. You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Sanctuary. If you enjoyed the show and would like to be an absolute bless poppet, you can help to keep the teapot full and the podcast ad-free by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Emma Newman. If you'd just like to buy me a nice cup of tea, go to ko-fi.com/Emma Newman. This episode was brought to you by 3 cups of tea, a bowl of homemade vegetable soup, and the memory of laughter from younger days. Go forth, my apple crumbles, and be lovely to each other.